Mint is still $15 a month for premium wireless. And if you haven't made the switch yet, here are 15 reasons why you should. One, it's $15 a month. Two, seriously, it's $15 a month. Three, no big contracts. Four, I use it. Five, my mom uses it. Are you playing me off? That's what's happening, right? Okay, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
When I remember the first day of spring practice, I'll never forget it. We get to practice and these guys are, you know, teaching me little things and how to, you know, block and how to take a stick route and things that someone that's never played the game have to learn. But Pete Carroll's son, Brendan Carroll, was a tight end coach. So he was very helpful. And I remember I was getting thrown around, man. I was like, why am I getting thrown around? These guys are throwing me around like a rag doll. I couldn't figure it out. And by the time practice was over, we're all in the locker room undressing and everyone's laughing at me. I'm like, man, if that was my first day, they're like making fun of me or what? I didn't realize it, but my pads were on backwards. So these guys were throwing me around because I didn't have my straps on, but I didn't know because I've never played the game. So I was being thrown around and they're laughing at me. The guys were like, man, give him a break. The guy's a volleyball player. He's never played the game in his life, you know? And after that day, they started to respect me. And, They like my go get 'em attitude.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the next episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. I'm still out in Southern California. Last interview of the week out here. We've got a special guest that I'll introduce here in just a second, but I want to welcome you back and thank you for continuing to come back to watch Game of Crimes. We're coming up here on the end of our fourth year, starting to begin our fifth year of this podcast. None of this would be possible without you folks. So thank you very much. I know this sounds weak, but right now that's the best I can do. If you're listening to this and you haven't been over to YouTube yet, do me a favor and go over there. Type in Game of Crimes podcast in the search bar at the top. Click subscribe, go down and download some episodes, listen to those. Click a like if you see something you like on there. And you know what? Send me your comments. I don't really enjoy the bad comments, but I do read them. So send them on over and Murph will take a look at them. So let's get into today's interview. We've got a special guest and you folks know that most of the time I have law enforcement, current and former law enforcement heroes. I bring in former military heroes, occasionally other first responders, firemen. I'm going to get to you eventually. That's an inside joke. That's a cop versus fireman kind of joke with our guest. He doesn't quite understand my sense of humor yet, but he'll learn. But occasionally we bring in a former bad guy, what we call a bad guy. And that's somebody that has been on the opposite side of that thin blue line that we're on. And, you know, I only bring them on here if they've accepted responsibility or they've cooperated. We've had some unbelievable people. Some of the former criminals that we've had on the show have become very good personal friends of mine. You guys remember Mundo from the Mexican Mafia. I was sitting with him last night, just having a good conversation. We got George Young's last interview before he passed away a few years ago. Mike Franzese from the Colombo crime family. George Christie recently from the president of the Hells Angels in L.A. for 35 years. Some of you think he didn't accept responsibility. Well, you know what? I don't think he did either, but he was here to tell his own story. So that's why I brought him on. Everybody likes to hear about the other side of the thin blue line. And that's what we've done today. And this one's a little bit different. I got this introduction from Mel Sosa here with the conference in Southern California, made the introduction, he and Santee. And this young man, his name is Owen Hansen. Owen, welcome to Game of Crimes, buddy.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you coming in. He had to come in early today. We're going to go on stage here in a couple hours, and he's going to tell his story to 700-800 cops out here. And the purpose is to learn from their side because, you know, people like me, I grew up in a blue-collar family, no criminals in my family. My dad was a Southern Baptist minister. No gangs in the little town I grew up in West Virginia, no motorcycle gangs, no street gangs, any of that. And I go out to be a cop. That's pretty naive, right?
That's right.
But and yours isn't quite the same story like that. You grew up in Redondo Beach?
Grew up in Redondo Beach, but I did grow up in that same family as you did. I had that blue-collar family. Father was a construction worker. Mother was a librarian. Right around 8 years old, mom decided that it was time to divorce pops. He had a drinking problem. And she said, hey, I'm taking my sister, which my sister went with mother, and my dad said, well, I'm taking my son, and I stayed with Pops. And that's where this journey began. And this is, you know, where I realized at such a young age, in order to be able to get into college, Pop's not going to be able to afford it on a construction salary. You know, I think at the time he was making $30,000 a year. And he told me that day, he says, I remember my mom was leaving and I was crying. I was so sad. I was watching her drive away and my sister was in the back sucking her thumb, crying, holding her blanket. I'm like, man,
heartbreaking,
right? You're like, you're not supposed to leave me, mom. What did I do wrong? Like, I've been brushing my teeth at night. You know, I've been going to bed when you tell me to, you know. And I remember that day she left and my pops is like, we don't cry in this family. And I was looking at my dad and I looked up to my dad, you know, he was my hero. And I said, okay, but dad, I won't cry. And I remember that day he says, come on, let's go down to the beach and play some volleyball. And that became my backbone of, you know, not thinking of my mother, not thinking of my sister that was gone, and understanding that, you know, sports is going to be able to get my mind off of that broken family. And that's what I did that day. I went down to the beach where we grew up, maybe five blocks from the house that I grew up in. You know, I grew up in a small little bungalow beach house, two bedrooms, one bath. Once my mom left, the curtains became sheets, you know, and the rose garden disappeared. And we started eating off of, you know, plates and plastic forks. And it became a bachelor pad, really. And
pad at a very young age.
At a very young age. I remember, you know, seeing my dad trying to bring like friends that were on the pro surf tour, like just to sleep in my bunk bed so he could, you know, cover the rent, cover the mortgage. And I remember that I didn't care what it took. I was going to make my dad proud. And that's what I did that day. I focused on volleyball and beach volleyball became my life, you know, in Hermosa Beach, Redondo Beach, Southern California. That's like the mecca of volleyball. And, you know, watching St. John Smith, Karch Karai, Mike Whitmarsh, all these famous volleyball players, you know, I wanted to be like them. And when these surfer friends of mine, when my dad's would come to the house, I looked up to him. I'm like, wow, I want to be a pro surfer. I want to be a pro volleyball player. And that was the Southern California lifestyle. And that's why the book was called The California Kid.
And the book he's talking about, we have right here. And we'll list it later on. I'm going to talk about it towards the end of the podcast. You can find this on Amazon. I believe that's where I got my copy. But we'll find out if Owen has a website when we finish up on the end of the podcast. It's very interesting reading. It's a quick read. You see, it's not real thick. It's how many pages? Almost 200 pages here. But it is one of those books that once you start reading it, if you're interested in other people, how they got into the situations and the circumstances that they're in and how they got out of it, there's a book. You need to read this one, California Kid. So sports is very instrumental in keeping a lot of people out of trouble. My kids, they played sport. I've got four kids. They played sports growing up, and it's a time occupier. But it sounds like you had a lot of freedom. Your dad was let you come and go, or was he really strict on you?
Actually, my dad was really strict. So he had this strict mentality that I had a curfew at 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. Saturday, he would let it go till 8 p.m.
But how old are you?
And, you know, at the time, this is between 8 all the way till I graduated high school. So I've never got to experience that, you know, that party life as a high schooler or drinking a beer or, you know, I feared my father. So it was you focus on your schoolwork and you focus on volleyball. There's no other in-betweens. And I remember after I got to high school, I was like 3.5 GPA, 3.6 GPA. And all of a sudden, you know, these college schools are starting to look at me for volleyball. You know, I had the University of Hawaii come visit us in this bungalow house that I lived in, you know, at Long Beach State, BYU, Pepperdine. And then I'm like, wow, I'm about to go on all these recruiting trips. And then finally we got the knock on the door that USC wanted to come watch a game.
That's not the University of South Carolina, is it?
That's not South Carolina. That's the University of Southern California. And you got to remember, being in Southern California, everyone wants to go to the University of Southern California. That's where the connections are made, the networking. My mother
went there for her master's degree. My uncle went there to play volleyball and was on one of the first volleyball teams there. So it was like it was in the family. And my whole life I've been wearing USC, you know, Cardinal and gold and rooting on the football team. And when that knock came on and my dad was, you know, his eyes lit up and he's like, wow, if you have the opportunity to go to USC, you got to go, son. And that's what we did.
Well, did the legacy of your family attending there, did that help any, or you earned this on your own merit?
No, I've been wearing that Cardinal and gold as a kid. So it was already in me. I was like, oh, wow, if I could go there, that's like number one.
Yeah.
But then we got to think, okay, how are we going to afford it? You know, and luckily Pops didn't make that much money. So they were able to get us 2/3 of a scholarship. And the rest was student loans and financial aid. So that's what I did. And once that knock came and we told Pops, I remember he was so fired up. His son was going to play at USC, and my mom obviously was happy. She was at my high school graduation and I was given a USC hat that day. And I was just so proud, you know, it was just such an honor. And, that's where my college journey began.
Which is a kind of the crux of this book or maybe the gateway to the reason you're sitting here in front of me right now. As good or bad as that sounds. So we talked a little bit about your background, your family there. And you know, divorce is so hard on families. I've been through divorce myself and wouldn't wish it on anybody. But the children, I think, probably suffer more than the adults do. My two sons, there's lots of questions, you know, and it certainly isn't the child's fault. But it does have an impact on you. I think that my oldest son a few years ago came to me and he and I went to a sports bar and sat down for about 3 hours just to answer all his questions, you know, because they've always had these questions. I'm sure you did with your mom, and very sorry for what you had to go through. Just a little bit about your neighborhood now. Did you guys, this is going to sound stupid when I say it, did you live on the beach at Redondo Beach?
No, we were about 5 blocks. So Redondo Beach at the time was, you know, you had your middle class and your upper class. Upper class was towards the beach. Middle class was further back or on the north side. And then on the north side at this time, there was a lot of Mexican community, more lower income homes. But you had your working class in the north side. And obviously where we lived, it was at the time, you know, you got to remember my dad bought the house for, I think, $100,000. You know, by the time we departed that house, I think he got, you know, $2 million. So it's a big difference when you look at people think of, oh, he's a spoon fed guy out of Redondo Beach. No, it wasn't like that at all. And, you know, I just grew up as a beach kid, you know, riding a skateboard down to the beach with a surfboard, volleyball in hand. And I just, that was my life, junior lifeguard. And I just loved, I was a waterman. I loved being in the ocean. I loved running on the soft sand. That was nice. My life. Yeah.
I remember coming out to LA as I moved up through DEA for meetings out here in Los Angeles, or we're in San Diego, but up in Los Angeles, and going down to Redondo Beach, there was a restaurant, Eat at Joe's.
Oh yeah.
And we went, they said, you got to eat here because this is where John Wayne used to come and have breakfast every morning. I still got the coffee mug from Eat at Joe's.
Eat at Joe's, famous. They got those big wood tables. Yep. It's a community table.
Looks like big picnic tables. Yeah,
picnic table. That's it.
And I was told that a lot of our DEA agents, the young guys, you know, they couldn't afford a place to live on their own. So they get 4 guys and they get a house there on Redondo Beach.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, how cool would that be as a young DEA agent? You're having a job that's, you know, the most exciting thing you're going to do in your life, and you get to living at the beach. Well, then we kind of rode through the neighborhoods and thought, yeah, okay, I understand this now. It wasn't quite the
it's not that beach lifestyle.
The glorious thing. Yeah,
that's right. At the time. Now fast forward, and it's obviously changed. I remember, though, a good story about a DEA agent. There was a DEA agent that lived a block from, actually about 4 houses down from my grandmother's house. Mm-hmm. Name's Mike, an older gentleman, probably about your age. And he had this gym in his backyard, and he would always invite the kids to work out there. And, cool. And he found out I was going to USC, and he was so proud. And I remember working out with this DE agent, and I thought it was so cool. I was like, wow, this is cool. I want to be a DE agent one day. Like I looked up to this man, right?
Yeah.
And he was so proud that I got this scholarship and I was off to, you know, play at USC. And, you know, I would come back during football season and volleyball season, and I'd go say hi and tell him what was going on. And he was just so proud of me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You remember his name?
His first name was Mike. I could find out his last name, but
I remember he used to always work undercover, and he had this S-Class Mercedes. And I was like, man, these DE agents make some money.
You know, I used to watch Miami Vice, and I thought it would be like that in Miami. I went to Miami in 87. Nothing like that. No fancy sports cars, no bling, you know, the silk shirts. I did have hair back then. It was a little long, but not like what you saw on TV. Now, in your neighborhood, there were some gang members, right?
Yeah. So when I went to Redondo High, I discovered, you know, there was gang members. You know, people are like, how is there gang members in Beach Cities? Well, like I said, it was middle class. So there was a gang, Redondo 13. And it was ran by the Mexican mafia, the Serranos. And at the time, I remember there's some what we call senors or big homies, which are, you know, the black hand. And they ran the neighborhood, and they collected the taxes, and they told their soldiers, their Serranos, what to do. And for me, it was very intriguing. When I went to high school, I always like wanted a piece of that life. Something down the road, I was like, gosh, it's so cool. You know, you watch Scarface and Goodfellas, you there's something about it. As a kid, you always want to be like a gangster, right? Mm-hmm. And when I saw these Serranos that had the same lifestyle as me, middle class, we kind of had something in common.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't driving a Mercedes Benz or a Cadillac Escalade and had living on the beach, you know? So I felt like I fit in with these guys and I could chop it up easily.
And did they become your friends?
Yeah, they became my friends just, you know, in high school and never to become a gang member. I was very, very strict. You know, I hadn't drank alcohol. I hadn't smoked cigarettes. I hadn't smoked marijuana, nothing. My dad was so strict. I was scared of my father. And if I did any of that and my father found out, I feel like he would have beat my ass. So I just avoided it. And I never brought those people around. And later on, you'll see when we talk about it, these people came back in my life. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
it's just strange neighbors. I mean, you know, compared to where I grew up, and typically you think that the gang members are very cliquish to the point where they don't want to even talk to outsiders. If you're not a member of our gang, you're not one of us. But apparently you didn't feel like that at all with these guys, right?
Listen, I have this personality. People tell me I'm like a chameleon. You know, I can fit in anywhere. And, you know, I have people that tell me like, man, you can talk to mobsters. You can talk to Mexican mafia members. You can talk to CEOs. You can talk to professional athletes. It's amazing how you adapt in the situation you get put in. Mm-hmm. So I feel like my charisma just brought that to me. Like these guys weren't hanging out with surfer white kids. I was like the only one, you know, they used to call me Weto. They were like, this is Weto, you know, and people would say, laugh. They're like, he's white on the outside, but he's brown on the in.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the joke around town because I'm running around with these Serranos, these Northside Redondo gang members, and I'm the only white kid around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, are you involved in any of their activities or?
No, you know, I'm just at the time, I'm just hanging out. You know, I'm not even drinking alcohol. I was just a straight edge kid. Yeah. And that's what they liked about me.
Wow. That's very different. There was an incident I read about in your book where you found a white powder in your house. You didn't know what it was. What was the reaction?
Yeah, at a young age, man. I remember my dad, like I said, my dad was an alcoholic, and that's kind of what caused the divorce. And it was right around that 8 years old. And I remember the beer bottles being broken, and I wanted to check out the scenery of the crime, right? And I remember my mom and dad were yelling at each other in the front, and I went to the garage where my dad would have this little guest house where he would drink alcohol. And I remember on the coffee table, there was some white powder. And I was like, wow, what is that? And to this day, I remember like, okay, this is all going together now. Now I see why my father had this drinking problem. He had a drug problem too. You know, he was using cocaine. He had a mistress, you know, all these things add up. And now I see why my mom had to divorce him.
Yeah.
And I'm not mad at the fact that they got divorced. Any woman that is put through that, I understand the situation. It's, you know, it's life.
But in the book, you talk about that white powder and you just looked at it. I guess you got something on your fingers or?
Yeah, I remember I was telling my ghostwriter, I caught it, and I remember my mom was looking at me going to school. She's like, "What's wrong with you?" And I didn't want to tell her that I touched that white powder, and I got a little on my tongue, you know, and it numbed my face, right? And I didn't want to tell mom because I didn't know what the hell was going on. So I just said, "I don't know, you know, I think I'm sick, mom."
Would she have whooped your butt?
She would have whipped my butt up. She probably whipped my dad's butt for leaving it out.
Tough lady, huh? All right, so we've got you in college now. You report to USC. Are you living in a dorm or where are you living?
Yeah, my first year I'm living in a dorm. My dorm roommate, Charlie Witt, big family out of San Ynez. And I remember this family is just loaded. They're living on a $80 million compound in San Ynez. They got, you know, strawberry farms, wine. They have the biggest farming, you know, Santa Barbara Farms, which is one of the biggest farms in that area. And they're producing strawberries, lettuce, you know, you name it, they're making it. And, you know, that was my first taste of like, okay, I'm around this money, right? That's what I call it. He's wearing Rolex. He's talking about his dad's private jet that cost, you know, $100 million. I'm like, where am I? Like, I've never even been on a plane, let alone a private jet. And I saw the Rolex and I was like, wow, let me touch that. You know, you hear about him, but you've never seen it living in a house of a father of a construction worker, right? So, you know, that was my first taste of being around money. And I'm like, man, I do not fit in here. Maybe I should have gone to the University of Hawaii, you know. And I felt like an outsider. I felt like, you know, I didn't belong there because everyone around had that same lifestyle. They all had that silver spoon.
Was he there to play volleyball?
Yeah, he was there to play volleyball.
So you're kind of in a sports dorm then, right?
Correct.
Okay, so you got all these competitors, even though you're on the same team.
Yes.
Wow. I can't imagine that kind of financial lifestyle growing up like that. But did you experience envy at that time? Like you're looking at that and like, I want some of that, or you're just in awe of somebody having that kind of lifestyle.
To be honest, I was at awe. Right. And I thought maybe this is like the net. You hear about this USC network. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to be like this guy. It's going to just be given to me. Right. And nothing in life is given to you. You know, you got to realize there's no free handouts. Mm-hmm. And if there is, there's something wrong.
That's a good lesson for young people today. You got to go out and earn this stuff.
That's right. And I had to earn a living. And I had to figure it out fast because I was so humiliated. You know, my roommates and my teammates were like, come on, let's go to Traddy's, which is the local bar, or the 901, which is another local bar, or the restaurant down the street. And I don't have two nickels to rub together. So how am I going to be able to go out to these spots? And, you know, I'm like, oh, sorry, I got to study for my test. And, you know, they're looking at me like, come on, let's go out with the fellows. And I didn't want to tell them I can't afford it. You know, that's embarrassing at that age. You're 18 years old. You don't want to tell these kids that you don't have money, because then what are you? You're nobody to them. So
really,
to me, that's how I felt, because everyone had money around me. Mm-hmm. So to me, it was humiliating.
There was nobody else on the team that came from your circumstances. I mean, not exactly your circumstances, but that did not have the financial resources that those five guys had.
Everyone at USC, I mean, we're even talking like the lowest level, that his parents were at least net worth of $10 million.
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy. It's just that Southern California, that private school, just that's what it targets, you know?
Yeah. Holy cow. What were you majoring in college?
At my freshman year, I decided to major in, I was really big into obviously construction and learning, you know, the trade, because my father was obviously a contractor. So I wanted to get the closest major where maybe in the future I could do some kind of development. And it really enlightened me. I remember as a kid working on construction sites and picking up debris and just being like, wow, looking at the foreman and saying, man, I want to be like that foreman or that superintendent. So they had a major that was called public policy and development. And it was for people that were willing to work for development companies or work for the city planning office. And I said, okay, you know what? That would be a good major for me. So it was PPD. It was called Public Policy and Development.
Great. So at some point, reading your book, you did start drinking with your volley team buddies, right?
Yeah. And I was scared, because you remember, my father was an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. So I already had that in the back of my head. If I start drinking, I'm going to be like my father. That's why my dad was so strict. So as soon as I got to college, I was like, this is why dad hasn't allowed me to drink. Because once I had that first sip, I was like, wow, now this all makes sense. This stuff's awesome.
You liked it?
I loved it.
And they started out on beer?
It was first beer with my roommate, Charlie. And next thing you know, he's like, come on, I'll pay for your cocktails. Come on. And then we're drinking cocktails. And then one of the guys bring out, you know, a bag of blow. And I'm like, oh, what's that? And once I had that first bump, it was like I was chasing that for the rest of my life.
So that's true.
That's true. 100%.
What was, I hope it's obvious that I've never tried cocaine, but I wouldn't know what that's like. What was was it a euphoric feeling? I don't know what it is.
It's a euphoric feeling. It's like you take that line and your face goes numb, but you feel like you're untouchable. I really felt like Superman. I would just feel like I could just flex. I could get any girl. I could drink any amount of cocktails I wanted. It was like you're untouchable. And that feeling that day when I did that line was like the benchmark that set me to where I became later on in life, becoming this international drug kingpin, because I kept chasing that rush, that feeling. Wow.
I just, everybody knows on the show that I'm just a small town country boy. I grew up in Tennessee and West Virginia. I have never, even though drugs have affected my life, people in my life, directly in my life, I've never understood how people could use drugs. You know, a lot of people like to say cocaine is organic because it comes from the coca plant. Let me tell you, when you first pour that gasoline in there, I don't think there's anything organic left after that. That's the first step.
And you can definitely smell that diesel when you're
acetone.
It's acetone. You can smell it. But
it's nasty. It's just so nasty. where was the cocaine coming from? I mean, I know you got rich friends, but they just got connections?
At the time, I started to watch, right? I started to watch them buy these bags and like, hey, we got to go to the Arco down the street. I'm like, okay. And I see them, dropping off $100 bills and giving it to, just a Mexican at the corner, right? And that was their dealer. And this is where I started to this ambitious mindset of mine started to kick in. And I watched these guys spend $100 for a bag that to me was not worth $100, right? But I don't know anything about drugs it was a gram, right? I don't know anything about drugs at the time. But I'm watching them and I'm with them and they're buying it constantly. Like every night they're all buying a gram. I'm watching. So that's like $600-$700 a week they're spending just in cocaine. And this is like, five, six guys on the team. And then later on in my sophomore year, I started to join the fraternity and I noticed everyone in the fraternity, and we're talking like 100 guys, were doing the same thing. So that's 100 grams right there a day. And then I'm watching my teammates, they're doing the same thing. So now all of a sudden I'm watching, I got 120 grams being bought in front of me on a daily basis. And that's when the light in my head went off.
The entrepreneurial side comes out.
It finally came out. And it was just survival though. Yeah. I'm not going to lie. It was like, okay, I think I can figure out a way to survive now.
This is going to be a funding source for you.
Yes.
Although you're using some of your product.
I'm using it, but not like later on in life. So you got to remember, I'm still going to school. I'm still getting good grades. I'm still playing on the volleyball team. So I knew we get drug tested. So like if I know we're in season and we're getting drug tested, I'm not using.
So you were getting drug tested.
That we got drug tested. Yeah.
Wow. So I guess the guys had figured out how long they had to wait from the last time they snorted if they knew a P-test was coming up.
48 hours usually. So if we got a piss test, I noticed the teammates would go hard that next day because they never saw a back-to-back pattern on a drug test.
Yeah.
So wow. It was a game. It was a cat and mouse game.
Yeah. And for our listeners, as we go along, they're going to see you do have a true, strong entrepreneurial side. You've created several businesses that we're going to talk about through the interview that might not be so common, but you were successful. It seems like you've been successful in every business venture you've ever tried.
Yeah, I definitely was successful until the end.
Yeah.
And that was obviously due to illegal activity.
Yep. So how did you – I can't wait till we get to talk about your sock drawer, but how did you figure – I mean, you've seen what's going on. How did you go from that transition to getting your own stash of coke so that you could be the guy that started to take care of these people? Coke, weed, whatever it was.
It was a dance, right? So I'm watching. I'm very good at reading the room. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading this room for months and months and say, okay, well, what's my game plan here? What's the chess move? And I kept watching and watching, and I saw where they're going, and I'm noticing like the bags were short. Like sometimes they'd get like 0.8, and sometimes it was smelt like more chemically than others. Sometimes I'd have to take a shit right after I snorted it, meaning it was cut with baby lactose. And I said, man, I think I have an avenue here. And that's when I started to drive back home. And I remember reaching out to one of the Northside Redondo gang members. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I told him, I said, hey, I think I'm onto something. I said, these guys at USC, I said, you know, I'm playing there. I said, they're all doing that white girl, and white girl on the street is, you know, cocaine. Mm-hmm. And I remember telling this Sereno, this homie from Northside Redondo, I remember telling him, he's like, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, I got a business opportunity for you. I said, you teach me how to bag this stuff up, weigh it. I said, you front it to me at a higher price than normal. And I have a feeling I can move this.
Why higher than they usually charge?
Because he has to front it.
Okay.
So I wanted to have him and give him an incentive. Obviously, I couldn't pay for it. I had no money. So I had to give the Sereno an incentive to give it to me on the front.
How did you get that idea? I mean, how old are you now?
You know, at the time, I'm 19 years old. But my idea was, okay, if we can all make money, then I make everyone happy. So my mindset was like, okay, what incentive can I offer him? Because I'm not just going to ask the guy to give it to me at his cost or give it to me what he sells it for on the street.
Even though you're friends.
Doesn't matter. Business is business. Cash talks. And I know that. These guys have bags, you know, wads of cash in their dickies. So they're not going to just say, here you go. We're going to give it to you what we sell it for on the street. Oh, you don't have cash. It just doesn't work like that. My father taught me morals and ethics, and you always pay for what you owe. So if I can offer this gentleman, you know, a bigger percentage and have it fronted, we're all winning. Mm-hmm. And that's how my mindset started.
And their response to you was?
Let's run it. I remember he says, let's try it. Right. And I told him, I said, I'm not driving with it. I'm scared of pops, right?
Yeah.
I said, I'm not driving with it, Scraps. I said, but do you think you could drop it off? And I remember that first time he dropped it off on Hoover Street and 28th Street. And that's literally like 30 steps from my fraternity house.
Wow.
So I wanted to be as close as possible because I lived in this bubble, right? If you're in that fraternity house, you're protected.
Yeah.
No cops are coming in there.
What was the size of that first drop to you?
That first one, I remember it came in a burger tray. It was a styrofoam tray. And I was like, what did he bring me? Some french fries and a burger, right? And I opened it up, and there was 8 ounces of cocaine.
Wow.
And I remember I opened it up and just, you smelt it. And it was that chemically smell we were just talking about, yeah. That ether. And you're like, wow. And I don't know what to do, right? He's like, here's the gram bags. Here's the scale. I'm like, okay, well, what'd I do? You put it on, you tear it. The bag evens out to zero, and then you take your spoon and you load it up and you put your grams in there. And once it's at one, just leave it at one. You go over a little, take it out. He says, there's 28 grams in an ounce. And I said, well, what do you think I should sell it to him for? He says, well, what's the market? I said, they're buying it for $100. He said, charge them $60.
Mint is still $15 a month for premium wireless. And if you haven't made the switch yet, here are 15 reasons why you should. One, it's $15 a month. Two, seriously, it's $15 a month. Three, no big contracts. Four, I use it. Five, my mom uses it. Are you playing me off? That's what's happening, right? Okay, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
I'm like, $60. You know, at the time he was giving me the ounces for it, I believe it was $700. So 60 times 28, you do the math. I'm making a little over $1,500. So I'm doubling up, you know. Mm-hmm. And he says, anytime you can double up in this game, you're winning. And I remember I went to my fraternity house, and my bunkie, my fraternity brother, was in there. He goes, what are you doing? And I said, I'm starting a new business and you're going to be part of it. Mm-hmm. And I made him an offer that he couldn't refuse. I said, every 20 grams that you sell, I'm going to give you one for free. And I'm just going to keep it here. I got to go to practice. And if I'm not here, you take care of it. And I remember I came back from practice and he goes, he was all chipped up. He's like, Bunky. I said, what's up? He goes, we've got good news and bad news. I said, what's the good news? He goes, we're sold out. And I said, well, what's the bad news? He goes, well, we need more. And I was like, oh, man. I said, well, this is a good problem to have. And that's when I opened that sock drawer and I had $20 bills just full to the brim. You know, it was the first time I've actually experienced like that. It felt like financial freedom. I'm not going to lie, Steve. Like I had two nickels. I didn't have two nickels to rub together. So it was like, okay, I can finally afford to take a girl out to Traditions tonight or the 901 Club. Mm-hmm. And it was the best feeling because now I felt like, okay, I don't have to worry about this month. Right. And it was an amazing feeling that I could provide for myself.
Mm-hmm. Did it ever cross your mind that this is illegal?
Of course. But my idea was, okay, I know I'm doing something illegal, but I'm going to get in and get out. I'm just going to use it to survive while in this college institution. And as soon as I get that college job working for that alumni, I'm done.
Yeah.
And that was the goal.
Yeah. I've heard 38 years as a cop, I've had a lot of people tell me I was just getting in for just a short time.
Yeah.
And years later, they're kind of in your situation.
Yeah.
Obviously, this thing continued to grow. Were you just limited to Coke or did it expand out into other things?
It expanded. I noticed I started, like I said, I was reading the room. I noticed these guys were popping Adderall to stay up for exams. I noticed they were taking Xanax to fall asleep from partying or from, you know, their Adderall intake. So I started to ask the question when I went down the north side, hey, can you get this? Can you get this? And sooner enough, they started providing me, you know, these things for pennies. You know, Adderall, I think they charged me $2 a pill. These guys were paying $10 and $20 for an Adderall. Wow. So, and then the Xanax were like 50 cents and these guys were paying $5. So it was like, to me, it was a numbers game. Like you're making 10X on your money. Like, okay, this is a no-brainer.
Looking at your return on investment, yeah. That's pretty high.
And I'm getting fronted, you know, so it's like getting a free bankroll.
You're still getting fronted.
I'm still getting fronted.
Wow.
They liked it. They just put it on me because they knew I was good for it. Yeah. Because they know where I'm at. I'm at USC.
Well, they know where your dad is.
They know everybody.
Yeah. Holy cow. I just thought that was so funny that sock drawer story, you know. Most guys they're stashing their money here where nobody can find it. I guess you're not worried about these rich kids coming and stealing from you.
They weren't stealing.
Yeah.
Yeah, they weren't stealing. They had no reason to.
Wow. Eventually, you got interested in football at USC, right?
That's right.
How did that come about? I mean, you're here on a volleyball scholarship.
I'm on a volleyball scholarship. I finally had that talk. I got called into the office of the volleyball coach. Coach Turhan, I remember it was his first year. He just replaced the coach that recruited me, Pat Powers. And Pat Powers was the one that got me on the squad with the scholarship. And Coach Turhan called me in his office. He says, Hanson, just you're not cutting it this year. He says, you're playing behind two All-Americans. He says, I'm going to have to redshirt you. I said, Coach, come on. I didn't come to USC to be redshirted. For the viewers that don't know what redshirting is, it's basically you take off a year. You don't lose a year of eligibility, but right. you're basically benched. And it's the most insulting thing that can happen in sports when you're, you know, an athlete. It's basically saying you're not good enough. So I was hurt. I'm not going to lie. You know, it felt like that day my mom left. I felt like, you know, this brotherhood I had, these teammates were like my family. And now all of a sudden I'm losing them. And I was bummed, man. I was like, man, coach. I said, what do you want me to do? He says, well, you need to work on your vertical jump. You need to work on your arm strength. You got a lot to do, Hanson. I said, coach, you know what? I'm going to work on that. And I'm going to be back next year. He said, yeah. I said, get ready. I'm coming for you. I remember. And I left that office and I slammed the door. I was so pissed off, Steve. And I said, that's it. I'm going to figure out a way to work on that jump and that arm strength. And I went to Gold's Gym, Redondo Beach. And that's where I used to work out, you know, on and off as a kid. You know, the memberships for the high schoolers were cheap. And I remember going in and finding the biggest guy in the gym. And, you know, I was just a kid in there always, just everyone knew who I was. And I went to the biggest guy in the gym. I said, man, what do I got to do? I need to work on my arm strength. I got to work on my vertical jump. He says, "You, what do you want?" I said, I don't care what I have to do. I don't care if it's illegal. What do I got to do? He says, you got to take steroids. And I said, fair enough. I said, well, where do I get them? He says, you're not going to be able to afford this. You know, I said, well, what is it? He's like, man, this bottle's $300, $400, $500. I said, well, well, what's my other alternative? And he says, well, you could go to the Tijuana border and go to the Farmacia. I said, well, I'm going to the Farmacia. I'm not spending $400 or $500 for a bottle that's this big. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, let me write a list out. And he wrote a list out what I should take. And I remember taking that. And I called my Sereno friend. I said, hey, you speak any Spanish? And he goes, I speak a little. I said, well, we're going to Tijuana. I said, I said, I got to get myself some steroids and I'm going to treat you some tacos and beer. And he says, let's go. And I remember, that first trip, I remember skinny kid, you know, volleyball player, took my homeboy from Northside Redondo to tacos and beer. And
is he all tatted up?
You know, he's not that bad. He couple on the arms, yeah, and nothing too bad. You know, you could tell he was a Sereno though, you know, the Ben Davis pants and the wife beaters and the white t-shirt, the heads of Chuck Taylor. So it's fun. So he said, man, you're crazy. And I said, well, I don't know about crazy, but I'm determined to make the volleyball team. I'm determined to be better than these All-Americans I'm playing behind. So I said, I'm going to go into these Farmacias, and I got this list. I said, I don't know how good the Spanish is. I don't know how good the English is. I said, I might need you. I might not. I don't know. I get in there. They speak perfect English. The bodybuilder sent me to the spot that everyone in there is American. Big guys. And I'm just pull out the list. And then I remember, okay, I need Winstrol. I need Anavar. I need Deca. I need testosterone cypionate. And she's like just putting all this stuff. And it has pictures of donkeys and horses and dogs. You know, this is for animals, right? Yeah. And I'm like, wow, okay. And I'm taking these pills and I'm dumping them in these bags. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm not going to walk these across the border. That's for sure. I said, do you have any medical tape? And she goes, yeah. And I remember I wore my compressor shorts from volleyball that day. And I went in the bathroom and she gave me some compressor shorts. And I put it around my legs and I strapped it up. And I put those compressor shorts on. And I'm still a skinny kid, so no one's going to notice, right? And, you know, I'm not big. No one would ever think anything. So we go back to that line over at San Ysidro. And we're waiting. And I'm sweating, man. I'm so stressed. I'm like, this is insane. I'm breaking the law right now. This is bad. This is not allowed, right? This, you're not supposed to do this. My dad would kill me. And Spanky's looking at me like, dude, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm okay, man. I'm going to be fine. You know, and he's, you know, half drunk from the tequila shots. And I get across I guess it's, what is it? Not ICE, what would be a customs agent. Mm-hmm. And I get there and they're like, are you bringing anything back? And my heart dropped, right? Like,
how do they know?
Like they know. They know. Like, you know, you're stressing. You're like, oh, he knew. He must have watched me do this. I said, no, sir. And he says, welcome back. And I was like, oh, my God. And Steve, to this day, I still get the goosebumps thinking about that rush.
Yeah.
I just broke the law and I just beat the feds, right? Like that in my mindset, it was just this rush that I knew I did something wrong. And it felt good. I'm not going to lie. It felt good. It was just like that line of coke. Yeah. It was the same feeling. It was like that time you hit the volleyball and it's in sports, right? Or that time you make that tackle. It's just like, you're like, wow, what a feeling. And that's why this relates to sports and so much. I tell people, this is why I compare it. Cause I'm an athlete. I'm an alpha, you know, I'm someone that's competitive. Mm-hmm. And to me, I felt like I was so competitive that I just did something illegal and I beat him, you know, I beat him out of it. And throughout my life, that's how this thing snowballed, no pun intended.
Wow. So you get back, you start using these meds. You're still going to Gold's Gym.
Still going to Gold's.
Obviously you're going to bulk up.
I'm bulking up. I'm working on that arm string. I'm working on my vertical. And, you know, I'm going back to Gold's. I'm going to USC because I'm still an athlete. I'm still allowed to train there. So Heritage Hall has a gym and, you know, the athletes train in a certain gym. And at the time we had a couple of our trainers there, our coaches had been on the volleyball team and the football team. They both worked. So there was a guy named Coach Char, and Char saw me working out one day and he's like, Hanson, what are you doing by yourself, man? I said, man, they redshirted me. He's like, fuck, dude, you're bulking up. What are you doing? I said, man, I'm just taking a lot of protein shakes. I said, Coach said, I got to work on my vertical, my arm strength. I said, I'm just getting ready, man. He goes, Hanson, you look like a fuck tight end. I said, what do you mean? He goes, why don't you walk on to the football team? I said, Char, I've never even played football. What are you talking about? He goes, Hanson, you got nothing to lose. I said, you know what? You're right, Char. I just got cut. He said, well, why not try? I said, well, what do I have to do? And he says, just show up to practice. They got a walk on. There's going to be 50 guys there. And I remember, Steve, I said, okay, I went back to my fraternity house that day and I said, what do I got to lose? Right. I got cut. Might as well do something. I'm an athlete. I'm bored to tears. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. I showed up, there was 50 guys and, everyone had cleats on. Everyone looked like football players. And here I am, this surfer kid from Redondo Beach with volleyball shoes on and some board shorts. And I'm just like, I don't have cleats on. I'm looking at everyone like, oh, man.
You know, Coach Char there?
Coach Char's there. Pete Carroll's there. Norm Chow. Coach Sarkisian. Kiffin. Every coach you can imagine.
Some big names in that group you just mentioned.
Man. They're all there. They're all there to watch these walk-ons. Because mm-hmm. every year they usually grab a couple walk-ons and fill the gaps. And I remember the drills for me were just simple. It's simple drills I've been doing my whole life, you know, like a box jump where you test your vertical, cone drills, which I've been doing my whole life for agility. Obviously I've never caught a football at this time. So they threw me five footballs and I caught three out of the five. And I was like, wow. Okay. And then the last test outside was running the 40. I'm like, well, I'm an athlete. I can run a 40. But I noticed everyone has cleats on. So I'm like, oh, they have cleats on for a reason. I think I was the second to the last guy to run the 40. And
are you on a grass field?
I'm on a grass field.
Okay.
And everyone's with their stopwatches. Coach Carroll, not, you know, Monica Kiffin's out there. Everyone's with their stopwatches. And I remember Coach Char and Coach Jamie said, Hanson, get up. You're going right now, 4-6. I'm like, okay. I got in that stance and I took off. Boom. 4-6. And Coach Carroll's looking at it. Norm Chow's over there. Kiffin, they're all looking at it like, now they're like this. I'm like, what's that mean? And Jamie and Coach Char said, hey, they want you to do it again. So I'm like, what happened? You know, I don't know what's going on.
Everybody stopwatching.
What happened, right? And I said, okay, I'll do it again. They're all gathering in. Boom. 4-6-2. And their eyes are lighting up, right? And they're whispering, like, who is this kid? Like, you know, they're wondering who I was. And we finish up the outside drills and now they take us to the weight room. You got to keep in mind, Steve, no one knows I'm on steroids, right? Right. So right. Now we're going to the weight room. I'm like, oh, this is the fun part. This is the fun part. Like that was difficult for me. This is where it gets fun. And I remember that they waited again. They waited for me to be the last guy. And I was like, okay. And it was the bench press. They wanted us to max out 225 as many times as we could. And I was like, dude, I was just bouncing it off my chest. You got to remember, I'm on all this testosterone and I'm just bouncing it and just hitting my chest like I'm lifting a broomstick with two feathers on the ends, right? And they're looking at me. I'm like 24, 25, 26, and I rack it. And I probably could have done another four. And at that time, you got everyone watching me. And all of a sudden, I was like, well, it was a good tryout, you know? What I have to lose? I didn't think anything of it.
Where were the other walk-ons? Were they watching?
They were all there, yeah. But these guys have been playing their whole lives. Like they're all Americans in high school. Some of them are going to junior college and you know, winning conferences. So I'm like, these guys are the studs. You know, I've never played the game. Let them have it. Right. And I remember 2 weeks later, they said they had a list and I was down in the weight room, just doing my drills, my box jumps and Coach Char and Jamie and all the coaches that were at that practice said, hey, Hanson, did you go check the list at Coach Carroll's office? For what? What's the point? Well, you might as well check it, see who made it. They got all the guys up there checking the list right now. So all these guys are walking down the stairs of Coach Carroll's office. He had this all glass building and it was this office just for him and disappointed faces, right? And I get up there and these guys are just shaking their heads, right? And I get up there and there's this letterhead, USC letterhead, the USC football helmet, and it says walk-ons, and it had one name, and it said Owen Hanson, and I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
I thought it was like April Fool's, right? I didn't know. I've never played the sport. How the hell did I just make the one of the greatest USC football teams of all time? And I remember going back down, and I was like, I didn't believe it. You know, I was like, is that real? They're like, no, you made the team, Hanson. I said, no way. And that was one of the best feelings, just to call my dad and tell him, like, he's been this dad that we've been watching USC football my whole childhood. And to tell him, like, Dad, I made the team. He couldn't believe it. He's like, no way. I said, Dad, I made the team. He's like, it was like, he was speechless. And I was so proud. You know, I like, my pops was my best friend. And so I made the team. And I remember the first day of spring practice. I'll never forget it. We get to practice and these guys are, you know, teaching me little things and how to, you know, block and how to take a stick route and things that someone that's never played the game have to learn.
Right. Right. And there's a lot to learn.
But Pete Carroll's son, Brendan Carroll, was a tight end coach. So he was very helpful. And I remember I was getting thrown around, man. I was like, why am I getting thrown around? These guys are throwing me around like a rag doll. I couldn't figure it out. And by the time practice was over, we're all in the locker room undressing and everyone's laughing at me. I'm like, man, fuck, it was my first day. They're like making fun of me or what? I didn't realize it, but my pads were on backwards. So these guys were throwing me around because I didn't have my straps on.
Yeah, and
my
pads had good handholds.
But I didn't know because I've never played the game. Yeah. So I was being thrown around and they're laughing at me. And I remember, the guys are like, man, give him a break. The guy's a volleyball player. He's never played the game in his life, you know. And after that day, they started to respect me.
Yeah.
And they liked my you know, go get him attitude.
Yeah. Wow. Now, so you're getting into the football team. Have you given up your side business?
No, listen, I told you it was a well-oiled machine. My fraternity brother was running that thing like a Fortune 500 company, right? Yeah. So he had the fraternity brothers. We were living in that bubble, and he would sell out, you know, every 2 days. And it was just wow. It was money coming in, you know, profiting, you know, a couple thousand a week and just sitting back and having him work for that Graham Commission.
And how much do you think you were making a week back then?
I mean, I would say like a short week, like 2000, and a good week, like during like rush week, it was like, you know, 5,000, like when the party started to pick up. And, you know, that was just off the coke. You know, sometimes the Xanax and the Adderall during finals would spike. You know, it was different times, different money.
And you went on, I want to move forward here to get on after college, but as a member of the USC football team, I know you won, you're wearing a ring over there.
Yeah, I won two national championships under Pete Carroll. Played with three Heisman Trophy winners, Carson Palmer, Matt Leinart, Reggie Bush. You know, 70 of my teammates went to the NFL.
How many?
70.
Wow.
Yeah, in 2 years.
That's a stacked team. Jeez. And so now you come out of college, you've got two championship rings. You've got all these connections within the USC alumni. I mean, you got connections everywhere, right?
We ran LA, man. We were like, we were the NFL team. You got to remember during that era, we didn't have the Rams or the Chargers or the Raiders at that time. We were the only football team in town. So we were the, you know, the professional football team, basically.
Wow. And what kind of a job did you end up with after that?
Six-figure job right out of college, working for a development company, go figure, building lifestyle centers. Big USC alumni hired me. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget, you know, that first day, and I just show that ring, man. It was like you're hired on the spot.
Opens doors, doesn't it?
Opens doors. That's why you go to USC, right? I tell people that's why people go there, because the connections, the family, the community, that's what it's about. You can't find that anywhere else in college.
Jeez. And I honestly never knew that, but I'm an East Coast guy, and I didn't play college sports.
Yeah.
I was lucky to get through college. I wasn't the brightest bulb in the student pool there, you know. So now you got a legit job. Are you still doing the coke stuff?
Stopped completely. I said, what's the point? I went to school, have that survive, make that so I survive to be able to fit in with the Joneses. And now I have this great job and real estate's my life, right? I'm starting to think, okay, now I'm going to get my broker's license. I can start working these deals where I'll do the development. I'll commission the sale and then I'll sell them, you know, I'll get both ends. And my mind's thinking bigger, you know, I don't need that job pushing dope. That wasn't for me. That was just to get by. And, this real estate, I loved it. I remember flying out to Bossier City, Shreveport And we had this lifestyle center. It was like 50 acres and it had Hooters and it had AMCs and it had Gaps and a Hilton hotel. And it was awesome. I was like, wow, this is great. I'm part of something big here. And they had me as a project engineer and I was running around and learning the business and I loved it. You know, I had a boss that was making $500,000 a year. And I was like, okay, this is a bright future. I could be like my boss. And then eventually I could be like the owner who's the developer. And I loved it. It was the hustle I loved. And I liked putting together the pieces. That was something big for me. And then that recession hit, Steve, 2007. I was the youngest one on that totem pole. And I remember my boss calling me in. He says, we got to let you go. And once again, I felt like that time I got cut from the volleyball team. My mom left me. I just had this great job. And I felt like that abandonment again. I'm like, what a terrible feeling.
Feel like the rock had been dropped on top of your head again.
Yeah.
One thing I forgot to ask you about when you were in college, you started like a concierge business or you had the connections.
Market concierge. I was really good at putting things together, right? Like if you wanted to go to Cabo and you wanted product down there, I'd be able to get it for you down there. And, you know, at a premium, you know, I remember strapping up, you know, 3 ounces of cocaine and going to Cabo for spring break and selling grams for $100 out there just because I had this concierge service. You know, if you wanted jet skis on the Cortez, I got a guy. And I just was very good at networking. And I would remind myself, okay, keep that business card, keep that phone number. In my mind, my Rolodex I had was unbelievable. And anything you needed, I remember guys would want like Laker seats on the floor. And I had a guy. And eventually, you'll find out I meet more connections throughout my bookmaking experiences. Right. But I knew when I went to SC, like, this, you're going to school to network. So earn that network.
I mean,
every bit of it.
You're hustling. It's it's just amazing that, you know, I guess your financial status at the beginning helped you to develop these skills, whereas the others had that silver spoon in their mouth and they didn't need to develop these kind of skills.
Yeah. And I was willing to do something they would never do. Right. So it was worth something to them because they didn't have to do it. They could use daddy's money and buy that $100 gram or, you know, $5,000 jet ski experience over the Sea of Cortez.
And I'm certainly not justifying anything that you did. I don't have to say it, but I think you can figure it out. I don't agree with anything you did, but I don't approve of anything. But you're surviving.
No, I'm trying to survive. And I agree with you, Steve. I broke the law and I deserve to go to prison. By golly, I earned that, you know. And I'm blessed that, you know, people like you took me down because I would be dead. And
well, that's one thing I want to talk about at the end is about letting the FBI take you down. The FBI? Sure. Come on, man.
I'm sorry.
And all my FBI brothers, it's a joke. Love you guys.
The bookmaking. You know, the DEA doesn't get involved in bookmaking.
No, we don't. Well, but you know what? There's always a drug side to all the crimes.
That's right.
It always comes back. And you mentioned sports betting. How did you get involved in that?
I told you, you know, my dad was my best friend, right? So what I do, I go back to my best friend. I said, Pops, I lost my job. And I begged him. I said, Dad, I need to do something. I already knew I had these connections throughout USC. And I knew I had these fraternity brothers that are, you know, already millionaires. I'm like, what could I do that's not illegal like I was doing in college, but I could get by for maybe a couple of years until the market picks up. And my father had an Italian bookmaker friend. And I was like, that's it. That's the spot. I see all my fraternity brothers betting on sports daily. And of course, the athletes love betting on sports. We know that. So I was like, you know what? That's my niche. And I said, Dad, I begged him. He said, no, son, you're not getting, you just graduated from USC. You're out of your mind. I said, just give me one chance, Dad. And I begged him days and days. And he said, fine, I'll just make the introduction. That's it. And I remember meeting Tony, the bookmaker, and I told him, I said, listen, Tony, I have this network that's unbelievable. I said, I just won 2 national championships. I got these fraternity brothers that are all living in Bel Air and Newport Beach and Beverly Hills. I said, let me just learn the game. I said, just give me a small percentage. Let me show you what I can do. And I remember he says, I'll pay you 20%. Whatever you take in bets, whatever they lose net, you'll get 20% of their losses. And at the time, you know, I don't have a job. So 20% sounds good.
But there's an incentive there to get as many bets in as you can.
I just want volume. Yeah. I'm going to every fraternity brother, every athlete I know. And I remember when I was working for the developer, there was always this contractor, the contractor for the whole project. And he was placing like $20,000 bets on the phone, betting on the Dodgers. And I'm like, okay. And I remembered, I said, if I could get to him, that would be like my whale. And I remember going to him, and Drew Patterson was his name. And I said, Drew, I said, I got an offer you can't refuse. I said, I'm working for one of the biggest bookmakers in the world right now. I said, they're called Macho Sports. I said, you know, I watched you when I was working under you. Hey, place these bets. I said, I noticed you place large bets. I said, my company is able to take those bets. And I said, I'm so confident that I'm going to pay you on Monday if you win. And if you lose, I'll collect on, you know, by a Thursday. And he was like, no way. No one pays on Monday. I said, I'm going to sweeten the deal. I said, I'm going to give you 10% off your losses. I'm only making 20%, Steve. So I'm losing half my commission, but this is my incentive to show these guys, these bookmakers, that I can do business with anybody. The guy starts losing, man, and I'm collecting that money and I'm paying and I'm giving him his 10% in losses and I'm paying this Italian bookmaker. And he's like, wow, you got some great customers, right? After 6 months, this guy loses $1 million. You know, so I'm like, oh, man. I just collected $1 million cash. I gave him back 10%. So I really collected 900,000 cash, but I'm giving 800,000 of it to these bookmakers. They got to be happy. This is just off of one customer in 6 months, Steve. And I remember they're like, wow, you got some whales, Red. I'm like, you got to bump my commission up. They don't want to bump it up. They're like, oh, we could get you to 30, but you need more customers. I'm like, I'm going to figure out a way to do this myself. And that's when my ambitiousness kicked in again. And I went to the Mecca, Costa Rica. And I figured out how I could run my own call center where I could have my servers offshore, how I can start my own website. And that's what I did. I used all the money that I made off my commissions and I saved it. And I started to book my own bets. And I started to have my own call center down there, my own servers. And I formed betodog.com. Everyone knew me as O-Dog in school. You know, that was my nickname on the football team, the volleyball team. Mm-hmm. So it was perfect. People knew what they were doing when they saw the website, Bet O-Dog. You're betting on O-Dog, right? You're betting against me. And that was my market. That was my niche. And I found my calling. I remember going to USC football games and passing out business cards. I had glasses made that had said Bet O-Dog on them. And I offered everyone a sweet deal. I said, you know what? I'm going to give you guys 10% off your losses. And if you pay me on Monday, I said, I'm going to give you 20% free play. Because a free play is basically, if you lose, say, $10,000, I'm going to give you $2,000 free play credit. So what happens is if you win that, it goes to your positive balance. But if you lose it, you don't lose anything. Mm-hmm. It's like giving a rock of crack to a crack addict, right? You give him one, you know he's going to keep betting. So I did that, Steve, in order for them to keep betting because I knew they're going to lose it. They can't just stop. And my business started to blow up. And then my mentors, these guys that were taking, you know, 80% of my money, ended up getting busted by the feds, by the FBI. Mm-hmm. And this whole time I'm thinking I'm untouchable, right? Because I didn't get busted. These guys got busted. They didn't know what was going on either. But I had separated myself to start my own company, Bet O-Dog. So I thought I was in the clear. And I remember I was like, okay, I'm untouchable. So then I started going after all their clients because they had no bookie now. They're all in the feds. And I started this empire, man. I was in like 40 states. I had A-list celebrities betting with me. Paris Hilton, I mentioned in the book, was betting with me. You know, I was partying in Vegas with Mike Tyson, Tito Ortiz, Chuck Liddell, all these big names. And I was like the man. I was this big LA bookie. And I was very good at wining and dining, providing this black market concierge service again. So now I'm taking bets. So you need a penthouse in Cabo. I got you. Oh, you want a Lakers tickets? I got you. You're my VIP customer. I'll take you to, you know, the Beverly Hills Hotel, whatever you need. And my idea and my business model was, instead of them going to Vegas, I'll bring Vegas to them so they don't have to go lose their money at Vegas. I wanted them to lose their money with me. And then I started the casino online where you could bet live with a blackjack dealer. So they had no reason to go to Vegas. People go to Vegas to spend money on the, you know, the restaurants, they get these, what they call, you know, kickbacks from the casinos where they comp your room, right, buy you food. I said, I can do the same thing. So you want a nice hotel at Beverly Hills or the Peninsula Hotel? I got you. You want a nice restaurant at Mr. Chow's? I got you. Because I know they're going to lose $100,000 that week. So to me, it's nothing.
And how old are you at this time?
25.
Good Lord. Unbelievable. Listen, we've been going a little while now. So what I'm going to do is call an end to episode one here. Folks, you got to come back because as interesting as this is, and I'm smiling like I'm envious. I'm amazed at the entrepreneurial skills of this guy. And how he was able to get people to just turn over their money to him, and he's benefiting on it. Your return on investment is much larger than you would ever get in any stock investment or any other financial instrument that I think of. But so you got to come back tomorrow and listen to the next episode, find out how this all escalates, and then all comes to a crash. So thanks again for joining us today. Come on back tomorrow again. If you're not on YouTube yet, do me a favor, go over and type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the search bar, click on that subscribe button, and continue to come back every week because I'm going to continue to bring the same studs and studettes that we've been bringing for almost 4 years now. God bless. We'll see you tomorrow.